Okay, and continuing, let's talk about the question of competing elites and no elites. This notion of competing elites is an important part of theories of bourgeois democracy and how it is the best system that there can be, and how the existence of competing elites is crucial for people, and in particular those who are not part of the elites, to exercise initiative by being able to choose among and thereby being able to influence the competing elites. For example, Robert A. Dahl, in his book Democracy and Its Critics, speaks to what he calls an MDP. MDP standing for Modern Dynamic Pluralist Society, and how this best serves what he also, another term of his, polyarchy, or another term he uses, polyarchy, which according to Dahl involves, quote, a set of political institutions that taken together distinguish modern representative democracy from all other political systems, unquote, and which, according to Dahl, make it the best of all possible political systems. Continuing on, polyarchy, according to Dahl, quote, provides a broad array of human rights and liberties that no actually existing real-world alternative to it can match. It provides a broad array of human rights and liberties that no actually existing real-world alternative to it can match. Integral to it, he goes on, is a generous zone of freedom and control that cannot be deeply or persistently invaded without destroying polyarchy itself. Although the institutions of polyarchy, he continues, do not guarantee the ease and vigor of citizen participation that could exist in principle in a small city-state, nor ensure that governments are closely controlled by the citizens or that policies invariably correspond with the desires of a majority of citizens, nonetheless, he says, quote, they make it unlikely in the extreme, listen carefully, unlikely in the extreme that a government will long pursue policies that deeply offend a majority of citizens. What is more, he says, those institutions even make it rather uncommon for a government to enforce policies to which a substantial number of citizens object and try to overturn by vigorously using the rights and opportunities available to them. If citizen control over collective decisions is more anemic than the robust control they would exercise if the dream of participatory democracy were ever realized, Dahl says, the capacity of citizens to exercise a veto power over the re-election and policies of elected officials is a powerful and frequently exercised means of preventing officials from imposing policies objectionable to many citizens, he concludes. Well, let's look at things in the actually existing real world. Let's take what Dahl has said here, which expresses a fairly commonly held affirmation of what is in reality bourgeois democracy, and see how this measures up and what it actually amounts to in this real world. Let's begin with the assertion, which Dahl makes emphatically, that in such a society it is, quote, unlikely in the extreme that a government will long pursue policies that deeply offend the majority of citizens. And what is more, these institutions even make it rather uncommon for a government to enforce policies to which a substantial number of citizens object and try to overturn by vigorously using their rights and opportunities available to them. Using the rights and opportunities available to them. In regard to this, I cannot help paraphrasing Lenin here. To say that Dahl might wish that there were a law against laughing in public. And for all we know, the Bush regime may yet oblige such a wish. Otherwise, if this statement of Dahl's were repeated among the millions and tens of millions who have tried by, quote, vigorously using the rights and opportunities available to them to prevent and then bring to an end the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq and numerous other policies of the Bush regime, which are not only opposed but deeply detested by a very substantial segment of the population in the U.S., probably even a majority. If Dahl's statement were repeated among such people, it would very likely be drowned out under a tidal wave of bitter laughter. And it is not just experience in this immediate period, but experience throughout the history of this country that has illustrated time and again, one, there is a ruling class that has interests which are very different from and fundamentally in opposition to those of the masses of citizens. Two, this ruling class in reality exercises a dictatorship, that is, a monopoly of political power backed up by and concentrated in a monopoly of armed power over the rest of society. And those who at any given time are administering that dictatorship will continue to pursue policies they are determined to carry out, even in the face of massive popular opposition, unless and until the larger interests of the ruling class dictate that it modify or even abandon a particular policy, or until that ruling class is overthrown. And three, elections will not provide an avenue for the realization of the desire of masses of people to see these policies and actions of the government changed. Although mass political resistance can, under certain circumstances, play a very important part in forcing changes in government policy, especially if this takes place in a larger context where these policies are running into real trouble and, among other things, are leading to heightened divisions within the ruling class itself. In that context, massive resistance can not only play an important part, but can have a significant impact. And if we look at more recent history, stepping back a few decades, we can see once again how the experience around Vietnam was a concentrated example of all this. I pointed to this before, but there were two elections in relation to Vietnam that were of great significance and pointed to as having great significance, which actually illustrate what I'm saying and debunk the notions that Dahl is putting forward. First, there was election in 1964 when the U.S. began to significantly escalate its involvement, quote-unquote, in Vietnam. This is one of the two elections for president of the United States that I actually voted for. The first one I was eligible to vote for, and I voted for Lyndon Johnson in 1964. I voted for Eldridge Cleaver in 1968, but that was a different story. But at the time, there was a very intense debate in the movement about whether or not to vote, and in particular, obviously, to vote for Johnson. Johnson was coming out on, you know, behalf of civil rights, making concessions in that whole arena to the massive upsurge. And at the same time, he was, by contrast with Goldwater, even while as president he was carrying out an escalation of the war, he was doing it while not talking in the crazy and extreme terms that his rival, the Republican candidate Goldwater, was. Goldwater was famous, or some would say infamous, for his statement at the time of his nomination at the Republican convention in 1964 that moderation, let me see if I can get it right, extremism in the pursuit of virtue is no crime and moderation in the pursuit of vice is no virtue, or something like that. In other words, extremism is good if it's for the right things, to boil it down to the essence. And he was talking in extreme terms about Vietnam, bombing them back to the Stone Age or language similar to that. And everyone was arguing that for these reasons, in particular with Vietnam in mind, you had to vote for Johnson. It was absolutely essential, you know, in terms of Vietnam as well as other things, to vote for Johnson. And I and some others that I knew were influenced and persuaded by this, and we went and held our noses, as people often do these days, and voted for Lyndon Johnson. And after the election was over and after Johnson had run his campaign ads talking about the extreme danger of what Goldwater would do in Vietnam, Johnson proceeded to massively escalate the war in Vietnam, both in bombing and in terms of beginning what became the process of sending hundreds of thousands more troops to Vietnam, which by the late 60s reached the level of 500,000. And of course, those of us who had been persuaded and cajoled and perhaps in retrospect coerced into voting for Johnson felt bitterly betrayed by this, and it was a very acute lesson. By the time the 1972 elections came around, and I spoke to this somewhat in my memoir, there was a big debate even inside of the forerunner of the party, the Revolutionary Union at that time, as well as much more broadly among the forces opposed, you know, in the movement broadly and those opposed to the Vietnam War, about whether or not it was necessary to vote for McGovern or to put it another way, against Nixon. There were those, you know, such as Label Bergman, whom I mentioned in the memoir, within the RU, the Revolutionary Union, who were arguing that it was our internationalist duty to the Vietnamese people to vote for McGovern and get Nixon out, because otherwise Nixon would escalate the war in Vietnam again and McGovern would bring an end to the war. Well, this time we didn't go for it. We had a lot of struggle. We examined the question seriously. We didn't just apply a dogmatic approach. I remember being up many nights agonizing, well, you know, over the question of, is this a particular set of circumstances which requires an exception to the general approach of not supporting or even holding your nose and voting for bourgeois electoral candidates? And coming to the conclusion on the basis of a lot of agonizing and wrangling with others that no, that this was not our, quote-unquote, our internationalist duty to the Vietnamese people, and our internationalist duty was better served by continuing to build mass resistance to that war as well as to the overall policies of the government and more fundamentally to the system, which is what we set out to do. But there were many who did get drawn into the whole McGovern thing. I mean, it would have been, it'd be interesting for those of you who weren't around at the time or paying attention to go back and look at films, if they are available, of a Democratic convention. I mean, it was, you know, it was, there was Jerry Rubin. All these other movement people were being welcomed into the killing embrace, brought back within the suffocating confines. And some of them feeling a certain sense of relief in believing that after years of trying to struggle to change things outside these confines, maybe there could be an avenue for doing so inside. And, of course, what happened in reality is that Nixon trounced McGovern in the elections. It was more or less through the machinery of bourgeois electoral politics and bourgeois politics in a more general sense set up that way. I mean, without going into too many particulars, McGovern was barely out of the gate running when his running mate, the vice presidential nominee, Thomas Eagleton, was exposed as having been a mental case and having sought psychiatric help, and so then he had to replace him with Sergeant Shriver of the Kennedy clan. And the whole thing was a debacle from the beginning, and Nixon won almost every state. And many people were demoralized by this, but what happened? Without going into all the international and other factors that fed into this, but to a significant degree because of this continuing struggle of the Vietnamese people and massive opposition to what the U.S. imperialism was doing in Vietnam, Nixon was forced to sign an agreement within a few months after the election, which led first to the withdrawal of U.S. troops and an attempt at Vietnamization, getting the Vietnamese to more fully fight the war with U.S. air power, and then led to the ultimate and very welcome defeat of imperialism and its puppet government in South Vietnam within 2 years, by 1975. You all seen those scenes that they lament so much, of the people scrambling to get on the helicopters, grabbing as it leaves the U.S. embassy, as the National Liberation Front troops kick down the gate and the fence to the U.S. Embassy in Saigon in 1975. Now, the important lesson for what we're talking about here is that in neither case, in neither 1964 nor in 1972, were the decisive elements of what went into the changes that came about brought about through the election. Quite the contrary. In 64, we voted for someone who wouldn't escalate the Vietnam War, and he escalated on a massive scale. In 72, many people voted against Nixon because he was going to escalate the war further, and he was forced to pull out. And that led to the ultimate defeat of the U.S. and its puppet government in South Vietnam. So in both cases, the seeming logic and the compelling pull that you cannot allow a horror like Goldwater or a horror like Nixon, and you've got to vote for the alternative because at least it won't be as bad, or maybe it'll even be much better, was not borne out at all in reality, because these elections are not the actual dynamics through which these decisions are made. They are not the actual forces compelling these changes of one kind or another. And this is, again, dramatically illustrated if you look at these two elections which in effect bracket the heavy involvement of the U.S. in Vietnam, 1964 in the one case and 1972 in the other. Let's have an exercise and let anyone explain to us how holding your nose and voting for the Democrat or enthusiastically voting for the Democrat in either or both cases led to and was responsible for changes of the one kind, negative or positive. It didn't happen that way because those are not the real dynamics and the real basis on which changes of one kind or another are brought about. And this is obviously extremely relevant now, where there is this massive, widespread hatred, in certain ways unprecedented in its scale and even in some senses in its depth, although there was a depth of hatred for Nixon that may have even surpassed this. But in many ways, unsurpassed, unprecedented hatred for the head of government and for the whole regime associated with that head of government. And yet people have great difficulty rupturing with the notion that the only possible avenue for changing the course of things in a significant and qualitative way is to get sucked back into the same dynamics which are set up to and which can only serve the interests of the ruling class and which have not and do not provide the means and channels through which changes in the interests of the people can be brought about. So in light of all this, we can see the fundamental error reflected in Dahl's assertion that, quote, the capacity of citizens to exercise a veto over the re-election and policies of elected officials is a powerful and frequently exercised means of preventing officials from imposing policies objectionable to many citizens. The means through which that happens is massive upsurge in resistance in combination with other factors going on, including resistance and struggle and revolution in other parts of the world, as well as other contradictions that the imperialists are running up against, even short of revolution to overthrow them. That is the means through which officials are prevented from continuing to impose policies objectionable to many people or many citizens. And here we get to the fundamental point that what Dahl extols here clearly amounts to a vision of a good society, in fact, of the best possible society, according to people like Dahl, in which the role of the masses of people, of the citizens, as they might put it, is reduced to one of acting as a check on the elites who actually make political decisions. It is another expression of the notion that the best possible political system is one in which there is not one supposedly uniform and monolithic elite, but competing elites. And the quote-unquote freedom of the masses of people, including the preservations of their human rights and liberties, resides ultimately in their ability to choose and perhaps maneuver between competing elites. and presumably to make the elites compete for their support, particularly as this takes place through elections. Well, to begin to refute this, or to refute it further, in order to show what it amounts to in reality, and to make clear that there is a much better kind of society in which the role of the masses of people as the masters of society is not only expressed much more fully, but takes place on a qualitatively different and whole greater dimension, let's begin with the exposition of basic fact that is concentrated in the following from Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? Speaking to the essential nature and role of elections as the ultimate expression of democracy in bourgeois society. And there it says, quote, to state it in a single sentence, elections are controlled by the bourgeoisie, are not the means through which basic decisions are made in any case, and are really for the primary purpose of legitimizing the system and the policies and actions of the ruling class, giving them the mantle of a popular mandate, and of channeling, confining, and controlling the political activity of the masses of people. To illustrate this further, and what is wrong with this notion of influencing the competing elites, as much as I love Malcolm X, I have to speak to limitations of his, which ultimately flowed from the fact that in the final analysis, his outlook was not that of the proletariat and of communism, although his development was in motion and was cut short by his death. In a speech that I referred to in the memoir, in which I listened to over and over again, and which I still love in many ways, The Ballot or the Bullet, Malcolm goes into this whole thing about how people shouldn't be slavishly dependent upon and loyal to the Democrats. And he even analyzed how the Democrats and the Republicans, I don't know, those of you familiar with his speech, are, you know, of the same species. They're both canines, both dogs, you know. One's a wolf and one's a fox, and on he goes like that. But in the end, what he proposes is a familiar device. Namely, he says, we shouldn't just be a tail on the Democrats. They take us for granted. He goes into a whole thing about, you know, Lyndon Johnson. You know, and when he first became president and he gets off the plane and he looks around for his friend Richard Russell, a Southern segregationist Democrat, you know, he says, he gets off the plane and what does he do? He says, where's Dickie? Now, who's Dickie? He's old Southern segregationist, white supremacist Richard Russell. No, that man is just too tricky because his best friend is still old Dickie. But what does Malcolm end up saying? Well, we shouldn't trust those Democrats. Look. Whom Johnson is in bed with, for example. And where does Johnson, you know, Johnson says, some people argue that Johnson can handle the Southern segregationists because he's from Texas and he knows them. He said, well, if that's the argument, what about Eastland, who was like an even more overt segregationist? He knows the Southerners even better. Why don't we have Eastland for president? So he does a lot of time punching holes in this idea of relying on the Democrat. But then ultimately, what does he say? Well, we should form a bloc. And then the Republicans will have to come to us, and the Democrats will have to come to us, and we'll go whichever one will do more for us. But what are the actual dynamics when this has been attempted? The Democrats come to you, and you put a bunch of demands on them and say, now, if you don't do this, and you don't do this, and you don't do this in our interest, why, we'll what? We'll vote for the Republicans? You see, that's it. You got the wolf and the fox. And one of them pretends to be for you, and the other one doesn't even pretend to be for you. And those are your choices. So, you know, what leverage do you have in this game? If the Democratic Party's role is to talk sometimes in terms that make you think that maybe with enough pressure applied to them, you can make them adopt some of the things that you think are urgently needed, and you try to put pressure on them to actually do that by threatening to vote for the Republicans, either openly or behind closed doors, they must laugh uproariously. Because they know you can't go and vote for the Republicans who don't even pretend to be for those things. So you have, even on those terms and on that level, you have no leverage against them. They have you, you don't have them. As long as you are looking at things as being concentrated within and finding their only possible or their best possible expression within these, yes, very killing confines. And it's only by breaking out of these confines to begin with that you can actually begin to influence things in a significant way. And by going up against the whole operation of this machinery and breaking free of it and challenging it in a fundamental way. Now, here the following from Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? Helps again to provide a concentrated summation of crucial points that are at issue here. Quote, many will say, how can the political system in a democracy, in a democratic country like the U.S., quote, serve to maintain the rule of the bourgeoisie over the proletariat when everyone has the right to choose the political leaders by participating in elections? The answer to this is that elections in such a society and the democratic process as a whole are a sham, and more than a sham, a cover for and indeed a vehicle through which domination over the exploited and oppressed is carried out by the exploiting, oppressing ruling class. In order to have a deeper and more solid foundation for a correct understanding of this question, and to recognize more fully how apologies for bourgeois democracy, like that of Dahl, represent fundamental distortions of reality, it is crucial to turn once again to the question of outlook and method, to the decisive importance of dialectical materialism, and on the other hand, the striking lack of materialism and lack of dialectics grounded in materialism in bourgeois democratic views and analyses. Now, I've spoken in other contexts to how the superstructure in any society, including in the society with which we're familiar, the U.S., does and fundamentally can only correspond to the character of the economic base. In other words, to the underlying social and above all production relations in which a capitalist class predominates in the ownership of the crucial means of production and in which others either have none of those means of production and therefore are forced to work for the capitalist class, which does, or have very little of them, and thereby constitute either the proletariat in the one case or the petty bourgeoisie in the other. And I've spoken to how if the superstructure, if the politics, the political processes, institutions, policies, and so on, come into any kind of serious conflict with the dynamics of that underlying economic base and the process of capitalist accumulation which drives it forward and shapes its character, if it comes into that kind of fundamental conflict, then chaos will result, the whole functioning of society will be disrupted, and unless you're prepared to follow that through to its full conclusion, in other words, to the overthrow of the system, you will be forced to recoil from that and to adopt and to adjust policies so that they come once again back into conformity with the fundamental nature and functioning of the underlying economic base and the whole process of capitalist accumulation as it takes place and takes shape, not only in the particular country, but today more than ever on an international scale. This is understanding this is crucial to understanding how and why things happen the way they do, including in particular how and why politicians always act the way they do. Why repeatedly everybody, even those who can't help themselves and go do it again, everybody has had this Charlie Brown with Lucy experience. You know, the famous thing of like she's going to hold a football for him to kick it, and the last minute she pulls it out and he keeps falling for it. She keeps doing it, you know, the Peanuts cartoon. Everybody's had this experience with the Democrats, or almost everybody, who's gotten involved in mainstream politics in one way or another. They send out the candidates. Remember in the 2004 election, they had this whole traveling road show, and they had Al Sharpton out there, and they had Dennis Kucinich, and they articulated some of what people wanted to hear, but Time magazine declared early on in the process, well, Sharpton gets the best popular response, but he's not a serious candidate. Why is he not a serious candidate? Not because Sharpton's a revolutionary, but because even the things Sharpton said, however sincerely he may or may not have believed them, even those things were outside the pale of what the Democratic Party could actually seriously pursue, even in an election, let alone what it could actually do if it came into office. And from the beginning, those, you know, conscious representatives of the ruling class were very well aware of that. Sharpton, whatever his individual intentions, performed a function, objectively, of drawing people who have a lot of progressive inclinations and are very dissatisfied or even deeply dissatisfied with the whole direction of things back into this bourgeois framework. And Sharpton actually articulated this competing elites. Recently, I saw him on, you know, one of these news channels. He explicitly articulated the competing elites theory, that the role of the masses is to influence what the elites do. And he sees his own position and his own function in relation to that role. But he was not, quote unquote, not a serious candidate, nor was Kucinich, because that had nothing to do with what the actual dynamics of the system were bringing forth and required. And so then you ended up with Kerry, and we all know what that was about. And it's the same Lucy and Charlie Brown over and over again. Maybe this time they'll actually hold the football. No. This time they will do what they always do, leaving you feeling the blues the day after, because that's in line with what their role is, not in some sort of otherworldly sense or some rigid dogmatic sense, but it's in line with the actual functioning of the economic base to which they, in an overall and ultimate sense, have to correspond and which they have to serve. Through a lot of complexity and struggle, this gets worked out, but that's what it ultimately gets shaped by and fundamentally is shaped by. Another thing that stands out in this that's crucial to grasp is that you have a monopoly of political power, not by elites detached in some way from any kind of underlying base, but by a monopoly of political power by people who, yes, occupy an elite position, but are rooted in definite class relations. And even beyond that, thinking back to the four alls, even more fundamentally than the class relations, they are a power rooted in the underlying social and, above all, production relations of a society. These political representatives of the mainstream political parties and politics are the expression in the superstructure, not that they don't have individual will and ambitions of their own, but in an ultimate and all-around sense, they are the expression in the superstructure of the underlying production relations of capitalism and the dynamics of capitalist accumulation, and they are the expression in the political sphere of the monopoly, first of all, of ownership of means of production by a class rooted in those production relations, a capitalist class which dominates the ownership, which owns billions of dollars of capital, whether it's in the form of loans or whether it's in the form of direct investment in production, owns and controls billions and billions of dollars of capital. These elite politicians are the expression of and the representatives of that class dominating in that way ownership of the means of production and through that control over the economy and of the production relations in which that's all rooted and the process and the dynamics of capitalist accumulation in which it all is driven forward. And that's why these elites are not free to act even as they will or might like to, and they're not free to respond to your pressure on them in any fundamental sense. They are not free to respond to that in a way that in any essential sense runs contrary to the class interests that they represent, as expressed in the monopoly of ownership of the means of production and is rooted in the underlying production relations of capitalism. And this is why, to put it simply, they act the way they do repeatedly. This is why they say one thing and do another. This is why they get you to vote for them and then sell you out every time. This is why the Democrats have no spine, etc., etc. There is a monopoly of political power, not for unrooted elites floating free in the air, but for a class and for even competing representatives of a class which monopolizes control of the economy and on that basis monopolizes political power as expressed in a concentrated way through armed power, and it determines in the final analysis who will be the representatives that serve it and how that power will be exercised. I don't mean, once again, you know, I had that article, there's no they, you know. There's not a committee of the ruling class sitting there, you know, passing out. In some Latin American country, they had, you know, these aristocracies that were, you know, an oligarchy. They were pretty close to running a country like that. But in the U.S., it's much more complex than that. Nevertheless, through the dynamics based on that underlying economic basis and through the political conflicts and how they're resolved through the ruling class, this is what sets the terms, the limits, the confines, and the character of political decision making. And understanding that is fundamental to understanding why politicians act the way they do and what is the actual means to effect significant social and political change, even short of revolution, and ultimately, in this highest expression, through revolution, to qualitatively and radically change the whole character of society and have that kind of qualitative and radical impact on the world. So all this points to the essential fact that what we're dealing with here is a dictatorship. There's a lot of popular misconception and a lot of deliberately developed misconception and misunderstanding of what dictatorship is and what it is not. It's either commonly and popularly and through the influence of the bourgeois mass media and bourgeois politicians and so on. Dictatorship is either understood to mean the rule of a single maniacal, all-powerful leader with a capital L, like a Hitler, or as it's put in bourgeois democratic terms, like a Stalin. Or, in any case, it's put that there's a small group of people who exercise power without allowing any rights to the masses of people. Any free expression, any right to political dissent, and so on. This is a commonly and popularly molded sense of what a dictatorship is. And what a dictatorship is not is any society where you have these kinds of elections I've been talking about and where people are allowed, as Dahl speaks to it, certain civil liberties and human rights. But in essence, a dictatorship, in a scientific understanding of it, is a monopoly of political power as expressed in a concentrated way through a monopoly of armed force, to impose and maintain that monopoly of political power in order, in turn, to preserve and to serve an underlying economic system and underlying economic and social relations. That is the essence of what a dictatorship is. A dictatorship may, in the case of bourgeois democracy, for example, allow people to vote on which group within the ruling class will exercise the functions of this dictatorship over them. What a brilliant scheme. Because you not only exercise dictatorship, but you involve those being dictated over in fostering and reinforcing the illusion that they're not being dictated over. And you'll hear some of these people say, I refuse to acknowledge that I'm being ruled over. Well, refuse to acknowledge it or not, you are. and your refusing to acknowledge it is only doing harm to yourself and others of like mind, because you can't change reality if you refuse to accept what that reality is. It is not the Huey Newton thing that you define phenomena in the desired manner and cause them to act accordingly. We don't exercise power by having some ability to define phenomena any way we would like and thereby cause them to act in a desired manner. You exercise political influence and ultimately political power by recognizing the reality that you're dealing with. And what the existing political power stems from, is rooted in, reinforces, and serves, and where your interests lie in relation to that, and then by moving accordingly, by looking at also the broad panoply of different forces and groups in society and how they relate to those fundamental terms. So this is a brilliant form of dictatorship for as long as they can have it. I'm sure they'll very determinedly and stubbornly cling to it, because it involves exercising dictatorship, as I said, while allowing people to feel and encouraging them to feel that they are exercising the power that's being exercised over them. You have to give them credit, for they've really hit upon and perfected something very clever in terms of perpetuating their rule and their interests. But this is nonetheless a dictatorship, and any time any section of society runs up against the actual interests that are being dictated in any significant way, you come up against the edge of this dictatorship. In periods of acute social crisis and mass outpouring of opposition, this becomes more clear. It bursts through more of the outward appearance and camouflage. In the whole upsurge, for example, the 60s and in the early 70s, many people could see this. I remember myself being in situations of virtual martial law, when you couldn't congregate in groups of more than a few on a corner, and you couldn't pass out literature openly. And it was much harder for people to talk about how there was no dictatorship in this society at that time. And we saw what happened. For example, in the recent L.A. rebellion, when the masses of people rebelled, the government didn't say, let's have a vote to decide whether we think their rebellion is justified or not. They sent out the National Guard, and then they sent out the army. Why? To restore order. And from the standpoint of the functioning of the bourgeois system, that was a logical thing to do. And even many other people who might have been sympathetic to the outrage that led to the rebellion around the whole Rodney King thing were confused by this, because, well, you know, where is this rebellion going to go? This, you know, there's chaos in the streets, and is it going to, you know, are they going to come over to my house and burn my house down or take my things? And even people who were sympathetic got caught up in that, but what they really got caught up was in the logic that the functioning of the bourgeois system required forcibly reimposing order. It did require that. The functioning of the bourgeois system, which is what led to the rebellion in the first place, required the reimposition by open and brutal force of order. In other words, by dictatorship. Acting on behalf of and reinforcing the class interests of the bourgeois ruling class and the social and production relations of which that bourgeoisie, in turn, is ultimately and fundamentally itself an expression. And if you didn't want to see order reimposed in that kind of way, then you would have to take up a very radical, if not outright revolutionary, position and say that it's better to have the chaos and disorder than to have the forcible reimposition and reinforcement of injustice. But it takes a radical standpoint, verging on a revolutionary one, to take that stand. And to take it thoroughly and in a deep way, it takes a scientific understanding of the actual relations and dynamics that are involved and how this is the actual exercise of dictatorship, even with certain democratic forms, in the interest of a definite class itself being the embodiment of definite social and, above all, production relations, and the underlying dynamics of accumulation through those production relations. And at the same time as this dictatorship has a monopoly of political power as expressed in a concentrated way as a monopoly of armed power, it also has a monopoly in molding public opinion, so that the way that people are inclined to act politically is in line with the interests of the class which exercises political power over them, which exercises dictatorship. Some of this even came through in the movie Bullworth. If you remember in Bullworth, a Warren Beatty character, Bullworth comes, you know, he's kind of lost it, but in losing it, he's come closer to the truth. He's lost his inhibitions and, you know, so he comes to this, candidates debate. And you have the Jim Lehrer types there from the media who are going to ask the questions of the candidate. They start asking him questions. He says, "Oh, man, this is really ridiculous. You know, the same people that pay us are paying you to ask us the questions." Well, this is in sort of populist terms a basic reflection, if not a thoroughly scientific analysis, of what's actually going on. It is the same people in the sense of the same class that's exercising political power in the interest of a system that they're the representatives of, who also are, that same class controls and monopolizes the media and the means of molding public opinion in various ways. Not just through the news, but in an overall sense, although there are opposition things come through, but in an overall sense in the culture as well, in the sphere of art and culture. You know, I was reading this book that I referred to in another context by Morris Berman, Dark Ages America. And it's one place in the book, it's very useful. He has a whole, you know, section about the lies that were told by the Bush regime going into the Iraq War. And so I took my book and I just marked the word, just put the word lies next to every one so I'd be able to find it easily. And it just goes on for page after page after page of the lies. And then he gets to something that really, I really enjoyed. He gets to Paula Zahn, you know, and she had people on talking about the weapons of mass destruction leading into the Iraq War. And one of the people on there was Scott Ritter. And so Scott Ritter forcefully made the argument, there is no evidence that Saddam Hussein and his government has weapons of mass destruction or is seeking to develop them. And then after she finished out, he's somewhere in the studio, and then he goes off the screen, and then she turns, she says, "Boy, he's really drunk the Saddam Hussein Kool-Aid, hasn't he?" But do you see any apologies on her part? She's rolling ahead doing the same thing over the next issue. Not because of her particular irksome personality. You know, I there was this guy named, I think Joel Stein was his name, wrote an article in the LA Times where he finally came out and said, well, it was very interesting, wrote an article saying we should not support the troops. It's basically a good cogent argument. Look, we don't support what they're doing, so why should we keep saying we support them? And he said, look, I understand these troops have to put up with a lot more, more terrible things than I ever have to confront in my life. All I have to do is watch Wolf Blitzer on the TV twice a day. And as much as that's, something I'd want to avoid, it's nothing like what soldiers have to put up with in Iraq. But what is the role of the Wolf Blitzers and the Paula Zahns? It's to mold and shape public opinion in such a way that when people come to act politically, they're already conditioned to act within the confines and in the interests of the bourgeois system. That was the point that Bulworth was getting at as well in his partial but important way. So to cite once again Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? The much vaunted freedom of expression in the democratic countries is not in opposition to, but is encompassed by and confined within the actual exercise of dictatorship by the bourgeoisie. It is not in opposition to, but is encompassed by and confined within the actual exercise of dictatorship by the bourgeoisie. This is for two basic reasons. Because the ruling class has a monopoly on the means of molding public opinion, and because its monopoly of armed force puts it in a position to suppress, as violently as necessary, any expression of ideas, as well as any action that poses a serious challenge to the established order. What Marx and Engels wrote in the Communist Manifesto is more true than ever in today's conditions. Quote, "The ruling ideas of each age have ever been the ideas of the ruling class." But again, with all this, this doesn't mean that the ruling class has everything sewn up. As I've spoken to in other contexts, there are profound contradictions in their system, which in these days especially are posing themselves in very acute terms. And especially at those times when these contradictions become intensified and assume acute expression, this sharpens divisions within the ruling class and provides much greater openings for mass resistance to develop and to have effect. And it poses more sharply the need for revolution and may lead to an opening for revolution. Now, at the present time, this may not appear to be so true. Because for reasons that I've analyzed before, for example, in the Pyramid of Power and other discussions, the one section of the ruling class is largely paralyzed at this point politically, incapable of formulating and fighting for any kind of coherent alternative, namely what's represented by a Democratic Party, incapable of formulating in a consistent way and fighting effectively for any kind of coherent alternative to the dominant program represented now in a concentrated way by the Bush regime for short. But A, that doesn't mean that there are not significant conflicts within the ruling class. The fact that someone like Murtha, for example, who is not a representative of the people or speaking on behalf of the oppressed people of the world, but who is speaking with great concern about serious problems that he sees arising already and potentially posing much greater difficulty for the ruling class, it's why he at least gets a hearing. He may get attacked, he may get shoved to the side, but he still gets a hearing because there's enough conflict within the ruling class that a position like that can come forward as a serious position, and he has certain particular credentials, long-time association with the military and so on, credentials and connections that he can say these things. But I must say, once again, back to our old friend Paul Azan, I saw him on Paul Azan recently talking about these murders in Haditha, and she went after him again with her fangs bared out. But what happened was interesting. He actually got angry and responded rather than backing up. And there was a rather sharp confrontation there, which I don't think was mainly staged. But someone like that being able to be, you know, express his views and be taken seriously in a certain context, even while marginalized to a certain degree, is an expression or a representation of the fact that there are significant conflicts within the ruling class even now. And also that what Murtha is warning about and some others represents the expression of concern over much greater contradictions that could emerge and erupt. So we shouldn't simply look at the temporary way in which contradictions within the ruling class are posed and see the significant aspect of paralysis on the part of one part of the ruling class grouped around the Democrats. But we should look more deeply and at the deeper dynamics and at the potential for these contradictions to become much more acutely expressed, which will have very sharply contradictory effects. On the one hand, it'll provide further, as Lenin said, cracks, fissures, and openings for mass outrage and anger to erupt on a large scale. On the other hand, it will lead, in fact, to even more vicious repression, including of any such mass eruptions and outbreaks of resistance and concerted efforts to affect and change government policy. So those dynamics or that dialectic will be acutely contradictory in that kind of way. But if we go back, just as we say and emphasize that what is important is not what the mass of people are doing at any given time, but what they'll be compelled to do by the actual workings and dynamics of the system, to paraphrase Marx. On the other hand, this also applies to the ruling class and to divisions and conflicts within the ruling class. What expression those take is not dependent primarily on what appears on the surface at any given time or even on the will of individual representatives of the ruling class, but on what are actually the underlying and driving dynamics. And if you go back to what is the larger grand strategy of the dominant force within the ruling class at this time and look at what that's going to run up against as they pursue that and continue to go from one offensive to the next, you can see the potential for contradictions in the world and in U.S. society overall to greatly sharpen and intensify, but also within the ruling class. And you can see in turn the potential for the dynamic and back and forth between that and what goes on among the masses of people. So it's very important to grasp that while the ruling class exercises dictatorship, that doesn't mean it has everything sewn up, it has absolute freedom, it has no problems, no difficulties, no necessity, to put it in basic terms, that it has to deal with. In fact, it has great necessity and is creating more necessity for itself, even as it pursues through this core at power now, its interests in the world. I mean, those grouped around Cheney and others who first formulated this grand strategy, which more or less became articulated once Bush came into office as a national security document in 2002, they have been arguing for basically since the early 90s that not only is there an opening here to do all these grand things of imposing American hegemony on the entire world in an unprecedented way and a way that would be unchallenged and even unchallengeable, but that this opening will close after a certain period of time. Other regional and even world powers will emerge. And if we don't seize the initiative, we won't be able to continue the kind of momentum that will be necessary to do this. And they even talked about how it'll be hard to get the people behind this. Not that they let the people decide, but they do want to do this with the people deluded and following behind them to the greatest degree possible. And they said this won't be so easy to do absent something like a new Pearl Harbor, which goes under the name these days of September 11th, 2001, whatever their role in that directly or indirectly may or may not have been, which is something that does need to be pursued to determine much more scientifically and fully. But whatever that is, this has provided them with their new Pearl Harbor, but even that's turning into its opposite. It's not the same situation it was when they went and attacked Afghanistan. They ran into much more massive opposition when they went from that to Iran. A lot of people were confused. Iraq. What does that have to do with the war on terror? Well, if you think it's a war on terror, maybe it's confusing. But if you understand it's a war for empire, it has everything to do with it. But that became a very acute contradiction because they were waging a war for empire in the name of a war on terror. And that contradiction significantly rebounded in their face. Didn't stop them from pursuing it aggressively, but it created all kinds of difficulties for them, even within the U.S., besides the difficulties they've had in actually imposing it on the ground, so to speak, and from the air. So they don't have everything all locked up. It's the nature of reality, it's the nature of their system as a particular expression of reality, that it is full of and driven by contradiction, and that it creates new, as certain contradictions are dealt with, either resolved or partially resolved, they give rise to new contradictions or old contradictions in new form. You go into Iraq, and then you've got the cut-and-run problem, the way things have turned out. You've got to aggressively pursue that, even with the difficulties you've encountered as a result of doing it in the first place. So you had a certain necessity not to lose this window of opportunity, quote-unquote, and then you've created new necessity for yourself, not just for others, but for yourself as well by going ahead and doing it. And it's very important to understand these dynamics in this kind of way and not to see, as many people do spontaneously, they're so powerful. Okay, I agree with you. They run everything. They control everything. They dictate everything. There's not a fucking thing we can do. No. They do monopolize everything, control everything, dictate everything, but they're riddled with, this is all riddled with contradiction, which has the potential, not just in some abstract historical sense, but in much more immediate terms, to become extremely acute. So this is a democracy in its outward form whose inner essence is dictatorship. Dictatorship by the capitalist class, or to use the French word, the bourgeoisie. And it is radically different, in a negative sense, from the political power, the exercise of political power that we are striving for. In other words, the dictatorship of the proletariat leading the masses of people to actually exercise rule in society and carry out the transformation of society in a radically different context, in a radically different way toward radically different objectives. And here I won't go into that at great length. This is discussed, for example, in my talks, Dictatorship and Democracy and the Socialist Transition to Communism, more recently in Views on Socialism and Communism and the Basis, the Goals, and the Methods of the Communist Revolution. But our objectives have to do with achieving these four alls that I've spoken of. The abolition of all class distinctions, of all the production relations on which they rest, of all the social relations that correspond to those production relations, and the revolutionizing of all the ideas that correspond to those social relations. Or it has to do, and put it in another terms, in which they speak, Marx and Engels, in the Communist Manifesto, it has to do with the radical rupture with traditional property relations of all sorts, not just the production relations, but the property relations involving those between men and women, for example, which historically have been and in a sense remain today property relations bound up with commodity production and exchange and with class relations of exploitation and oppression. It has to do with the radical rupture with all that and with all the ideas that go along with that, and bringing into being radically different and liberating production, social, political relations, and the corresponding ideas that serve and further develop those emancipating relations. That's what we're all about, and the democracy that takes form under that form of rule by the proletariat leading the broad masses of people is radically different. Not only in that for the first time and increasingly it actually gives political power or provides a basis for political power to be exercised over essential decision-making by the masses of people, which can never happen in a society ruled by an exploiting class, including the bourgeois democracy of capitalism, but also provides the basis for a flourishing on an unprecedented scale of individuality and of individual rights in a way that can never happen either under the rule of an exploiting class, where individuals find their position in society and their freedom in terms of their social and class position and find it limited by that and confined and shaped by that. But also, these rights have to do with the masses of people coming to increasingly consciously not only rule society, but transform it and advance to the achievement of those four alls and those two radical ruptures and advance beyond the point in which the division of society into classes with antagonistically opposed interests and with that the need for a state, a dictatorship to impose the interests of the ruling class over the rest of society, where all that can be abolished, surpassed, and moved beyond. And the democracy that we seek to effect under the rule of the proletariat leading the broad mass of people is guided by and inspired by and aims for those far-reaching aims. And nothing less than that. And the democracy that has to be effected has to, at every point, increasingly be an expression of the advance toward those aims. All of that. And we have to find the ways to lead and give expression to the continually ever greater expression of democracy in that context, in that sense, and toward those aims. So as a coming back from that to the ugly present reality, once again we have to emphasize that the Democrats, no less than the Republicans, are a ruling class political party serving the interests of that class and the system over which that class rules and of which that class is itself an expression. They may be weak and flabby and spineless at this particular point to a significant degree, but they are weak, flabby, and spineless in that context. They are weak, flabby, spineless in pursuit of the interests of the ruling class to the degree that that characterizes how they are. But they are no less representatives of that ruling class, and they will no less fight for the interests of that ruling class against the interests of the masses of people. And that's why you see things like the conflict played out in the 2004 Democratic Convention, where the acute contradiction was expressed between the stage on the one hand and the floor on the other. And all the things I've been speaking to are the reasons why that was expressed that way. Now I want to move on and talk about, flowing from what I've said so far, talk about two fundamentally different and opposed views of freedom: the communist and the bourgeois view of freedom. In the concluding section of a book written 15 years ago or so, Phony Communism is Dead, Long Live Real Communism, I spoke to this question of, as I put it there, two world outlooks, two opposing views of freedom. And I returned to this more deeply in a recent talk, excerpts of which have been published recently under the title Views on Socialism and Communism, A Radically New Kind of State, A Radically Different and Far Greater Vision of Freedom. Here I want to speak to certain aspects of this, in particular the concepts of negative and, on the other hand, positive freedom, and related notions and distortions concerning totalitarian utopian horrors. In Dark Ages America, the author Morris Berman refers to the discussion of these different concepts of freedom by the historian Isaiah Berlin. Berman points out that the notion of negative freedom, quote, the right for individuals to essentially be left alone to do what they want, so long as it doesn't interfere with the rights of others, as Berman puts it, lies at the heart of liberal democratic politics. And, says Berman, so far so good. But Berman does not by any means one-sidedly uphold the negative notion of freedom that he's just characterized. In fact, he argues, quote, the problem is that Berlin neglected to examine the downside of negative freedom, which renders his analysis lopsided. Negative freedom is essentially a position of absence. It corresponds perfectly to the laissez-faire economy, characteristic of capitalism in its usual form. And Berman has significant criticisms of the laissez-faire economy and a society based on it. But at the same time, he buys into completely distorted notions of what totalitarianism, and as we shall see in a minute, this means in particular communism, is all about and what it aims for. Referring to Isaiah Berlin's 1958 lecture at Oxford University in England, titled Two Concepts of Liberty, Berman writes, quote, using communism as the worst-case scenario, Berlin spent most of the lecture, and in fact most of his life, focusing on the downside of positive freedom, which is certainly real. And then Berman goes on, all utopian schemes... all utopian schemes shade into their totalitarian opposite because of the arrogance inherent in the position that I know better than someone else what his true desires are, his hidden potential is, and am willing to coerce him into living the way he ought to live, unquote. This is Berman's characterization of what constitutes positive freedom. In other words, it's not just a freedom to be left alone to do what you want, but it's a freedom that tells you what you're actively and positively supposed to want and therefore supposed to do, and will be imposed on you by those who arrogantly believe that they know better than you what it is you actually should want and should do therefore. Now, there are so many things wrong with this that if I could only speak to them all if I took up another few days to do so. And since we don't have time for that, and it probably isn't worth it, I'm going to speak more briefly to it. First of all, on a very basic level, communism, as anyone who has engaged it even more superficially should know, is not a utopian system, neither in conception nor in the way in which it's found expression in reality in society, socialist society up to this point. As a matter of fact, a little reading of Marx and Engels would have brought this rather quickly and sharply to light. Marx and Engels spent quite a bit of effort explicitly differentiating themselves from utopian notions. For example, in the Communist Manifesto, there's a whole section criticizing utopian socialist notions and ideas and counterposing them to the scientific approach that Marx and Engels were bringing forward. And Engels wrote a book. Actually, it's part of Anti-During, but was published separately, under the title Socialism, Utopian and Scientific. Now, by this, Engels didn't mean, by utopian and scientific, he didn't mean it's utopian and scientific. He meant there's a utopian version, and what I'm fighting for is the scientific version of socialism or communism. So even a superficial engagement with Marxism would have told you there's something wrong with the idea that communism proceeds from some utopian notion which inevitably turns into some totalitarian nightmare. But this concept of communism as the quote-unquote worst-case scenario of totalitarianism, a concept based on the notion that the leaders of such a society think they know better than the people themselves what is good for them and what they want and need, or should want and need, this has nothing to do with the principles of communism or with the revolutionary struggle to bring a communist world into being. That's not to say that people calling themselves communists have never acted in that way, but this has nothing to do with the principles of communism or with the revolutionary struggle based on those principles to bring a communist world into being. There never has been and never could be a society or a world. There never could be human existence without necessity and, for that matter, without coercion in one form or another. The question is, what is the understanding of the relation between necessity and coercion on the one hand and freedom on the other hand, and between self-conscious emancipation on the one hand and the underlying material conditions on the other hand? Again, I have spoken to this at some length in Views on Socialism and Communism, so I'm only going to touch on this briefly here. What I emphasized there in that talk, Views on Socialism and Communism, is the understanding, the scientific understanding, that freedom actually resides not in the exercise of some free will independently of all underlying conditions or social constraints, but resides rather in the recognition and, more than that, the transformation of necessity, both that imposed by nature, if you want to put it that way, and that imposed by social relations at a given time, including international relations. Now, there is in the communist revolution, but this is not unique to it, this is true in all societies, but there is openly in the communist revolution the assertion of leadership in the struggle to get to communism, in the transition, the world historic advance from the bourgeois epoch and capitalist society and imperialism to the epoch of communism, there is the open assertion of a need for leadership, for all the reasons that if you actually read Lenin, he analyzed in a very important way in things like what is to be done. And there is at any given time, in one way or another, the phenomenon that terms are going to be set. This is another way of expressing the role of necessity or the influence of necessity. They will be set both by objective reality in a larger sense, and they will also be set, yes, through the conscious actions of human beings as individuals, but more effectively as social forces. This happens all the time in capitalist society. There's the necessity, for example, on a basic level, for people to find work. Some people, especially in the more privileged middle strata, have all kinds of illusions about the freedom they have, but once in a while even they are brought back down to the reality when they have to go search for work or a livelihood, when all of a sudden the position they've held for many years is eliminated. And they even have to pick up and move from one city to another, not because they always had a dream ever since they were a three-year-old to live in that city, but because this is the only way they can make a livelihood, at least one commensurate with the kind of life that they've become accustomed to and believe that they have a necessity for. And whether they want to acknowledge it or not, they're always being confronted with terms and necessity imposed on them socially and politically. Let's take some of the better aspirations of some of the better and more progressive people. They don't like, and they're disturbed, perhaps deeply disturbed, by many social inequalities that exist between men and women in the form of national oppression and in other ways. But these terms have been set by the nature and by the dynamics of the society, and they don't get to choose to just abolish them because they hate them. Even if they do, they are forced to respond to conditions and terms set and imposed on them by forces above and beyond them. And this will always be true for human beings in any society. The difference in communist society is that class divisions and the corresponding outlook that goes along with it do not stand as an obstacle to and interfere with the efforts of human beings, individually and above all, cooperatively and collectively, to respond to the necessity they face at any given time. We are still in the era of human history where any individual's or group's attempts to respond to necessity not only has to confront that necessity in a general sense, but faces in attempting to do so the obstacles imposed by social and class divisions and the corresponding ideas and outlooks. And the difference in communist society is not that we will no longer face necessity or no terms will be set not only by nature but also socially, but that in a qualitatively different and greater way, human beings individually and above all collectively can confront and approach the transformation of this necessity without the hindrance of class and social antagonisms and the corresponding ideas, including the ways in which an understanding of reality is distorted through the prism of these antagonistic social and class relations and the ideas and outlooks that correspond to them. Between here and communist society is where the real difficulty resides, at least from the perspective from which we sit now. Perhaps to people under communism, they'll see this whole thing differently. And our difficulties will appear quite differently to them in one way or another. But from our perspective, between here and the achievement of communism is where the acute contradictions get posed and where the difficulties come in. Because it requires leadership to do this. And leadership does have to set certain terms. Look, I am sick and tired of listening to creationist arguments attacking evolution. Shut the fuck up! Because every time science makes a new breakthrough, it's like, pointed out in what's soon to be the book on evolution. You know, it's the God of the gaps. A new fossil is found. Now you've got two gaps, one on either side of a new fossil. And these people consciously seek to wear down the scientists and others who would argue, you know, scientifically and honestly, the case for evolution and why it's important for people to understand that this is one of the most well-established facts in all of science. But these other people are not interested in that. They have an agenda, and they're driven by that agenda, the way we're always accused of doing. They're driven by that agenda. They're not interested in a scientific approach to this. They reject the scientific approach to it. They have a quote-unquote higher truth, which is greater than anything science can discover. Well, why am I raising this now? When we get to socialist society, I'm sorry, but they're going to have to shut up. They can argue among themselves and in their houses about it, but what I mean by they're going to have to shut up is there going to be policy about curriculum in the schools. And by the way, there is policy about curriculum in the schools now, in case anybody hadn't noticed. And there's battle over what that should be, and this will be true in socialist society, but it'll be on an entirely different foundation and in radically different terms. And scientists in socialist society won't be consumed. You know, Stephen Jay Gould finally said, let's not debate with these people anymore. Because it just consumes us in this, and you cannot have an honest debate with them, and it just serves their purposes, making their ideas seem like something legitimate to debate. Well, there is a time. This is the point, you know, in opposition to John Stuart Mill. There is a time when you have to close a debate and say that's enough about that, because the truth of this can be known. You know, it has been established from many broad avenues and interwoven and mutually reinforcing ways, and it's time to settle the verdict on that and turn our attention to other questions. That happens in any society, but it will happen in a radically different way through radically different means and on a radically different foundation in socialist society and still more in communist society. So this notion of communism as some utopianism turned totalitarian horror where people know better than others is really very much in opposition to the essence of what communism is about. And not only that, it's in very much in opposition to reality. Yes, when you have individuals and groups who exercise a disproportionate influence over society, which you will have in the transition to communism, not because we invented it with the advent of the socialist revolution, but because we inherited it from thousands of years of class-divided society, and while we're moving to overcome it, it will be a whole historical period until we can fully overcome it. So yes, there will be, through that transition and decreasingly as we move forward, a situation in which certain individuals and groups will exert a disproportionate influence over the direction of society. Overcoming and getting beyond that is, in a certain sense, the essence of or a concentrated expression of the whole aims of the communist revolution. But we don't get to abolish it like that through our will, because it's rooted in underlying material reality and contradictions, in other words, necessity, that we have to transform through a whole historical era of struggle. And while you have that disproportionate influence, you always have the potential for that disproportionate influence to be exercised in ways that run against the interests of the masses of people and against the very objectives in whose name that influence is being exerted. In other words, there's a potential for communists to turn into revisionists, to turn into people who, rather than upholding and fighting for the aims and objectives of and the advance toward communism, embody and represent and fight for policies which objectively, whatever their intentions are, objectively lead back in the direction of capitalism. This can happen, and we bitterly experience that it has happened. But again, this is not unique to socialism. This is not something that socialism brought into being through the utopian horrors that are brought forward and transformed into totalitarianism by a handful of people thinking they know better than everybody else what's good for them. This is something that we inherit inevitably inherit, can't avoid inheriting from thousands of years of society being divided into classes and from thousands of years in which those two radical ruptures have not been made. In other words, in which traditional property relations and traditional ideas corresponding to them have been in effect and have been enforced on society, flowing from the underlying material conditions and contradictions. But this idea that communism consists of some utopianism where a few people know better than others and seek to impose on them the ways in which they ought to think and ought to live runs contrary not only to the basic conception of communism, but to the practice of socialist society. For example, it's been pointed out by Raymond Lott and others that in China, just to take one example, in the realm of consumer products, there was a whole policy of having repeated surveys taken by the people, for example, working in the consumer sector, to go out to the potential consumers, the masses of people, and to do what we call applying the mass line, to hold investigation among them to find out what kind of consumer items with what quality and what, you know, quantity, etc., they would like to see, and to work out together with, for example, not only consumers, but the parts of the units of the economy that produce these consumer items, to work out better ways of producing things that drew from these investigations among the masses. Now, that doesn't mean they went out and took a poll or did a survey and ignored the larger necessities of the economy, but it means repeatedly drawing on the opinions of the masses, in this case about consumer items, and integrating that into an overall and synthesized plan that took into account all the various dimensions, needs of the economy, and all the contradictions that are involved in developing the economy increasingly in the interests of the masses of people. But even on this basic level, the idea that few people sat around and said, what the masses all, you know, like for example, there's the idea in China, all the masses wore these blue and gray uniforms. They all were a bunch of blue and gray ants. Supposedly because Mao and a few others thought that if everybody wore blue and gray and all looked like ants, it'd be easier to control them all and, you know, treat them all like a huge population to be herded around of indistinguishable people, one interchangeable with the other. And this ignores, once again, the reality and the necessity. I mean, when I was in China, one of the things I noticed was the children had these remarkably beautiful, variegated, many-colored clothes, while many of the adults still wore much simpler clothes. And this was part of a transition. When you had, see this once again, this is the total idealism of all the attacks on these revolutions, totally ignoring what the conditions were like for the masses of people before the revolution and why this revolution happened in the first place. People in China used to wear cotton clothes, including in the winter, that they could only have one pair of them, and they repeatedly put padding on them to cover them up when they ripped apart because they couldn't afford another pair of clothes. And soon, basically, there were more holes in clothes than what they were wearing, even in the winter, including in the northeast of China where it's bitterly cold. People were starving. People were selling their children. People were selling their daughters into prostitution. People were suffocating their daughters at birth because girl children were considered less valuable than boys, and there wasn't enough to go around to feed all the children. And there was no contraception, and there was no abortion, and so on for the masses of people. These are the conditions that gave rise to the revolution in the first place, and these are the conditions that the revolution set out to overcome. Once the new power was established, mass starvation, lack of clothing, lack of decent shelter, including in the winter, lack of sanitary conditions. And when they began to mass produce clothes for the people, the first thing they worried about was not producing dyes and running them through a second run to dye the clothes in many different colors. The first thing they were concerned about was that everybody would have enough clothes to protect them from the winter and to enable them to live a life worthy of a human being. You know, there were like 500 million and then 600 and 700 and more 100 million people in China as the population grew during the course of the few decades of socialism. That's a lot of people to provide clothes for. That had never been a concern of the imperialists and those aligned with them in the old society. But now this was one of the primary concerns of the new government. So they mass-produced clothes, and they did it in simple colors so that they could mass-produce them to provide enough clothing for everybody. Then once that basic need had been fulfilled, they began to develop the processes of dyeing the clothes and getting many different colors. And they did it first for the children, because the children are the future. Because the children are the ones who ought to have the bright colors that correspond to the bright future that they were still could look forward to as long as socialism lasted. And then they began to expand it out from that. This is the reality, and it's a completely upside down from these absolutely unprincipled and disgusting attacks, which are that perfect combination that Mark Twain spoke about, the perfect combination of ignorance and arrogance, the perfect expression of ignoring deliberately or unconsciously and out of ignorance the necessity and the reality that people faced and how they were setting about and how they were able to set about transforming that necessity in a whole new and radically different way as a result of the masses of people having risen up in a revolution, being led by the communists, seizing power and beginning to more and more consciously transform society in their interests, yes, with definite mistakes that were made and shortcomings and limitations. So the superficiality of this kind of analysis screams out at us. But from a scientific materialist standpoint, we can understand that until the advance to communism is actually achieved, in all situations in which society is divided into classes, and there are the corresponding social inequalities, someone, or better said, some group of people is going to have a greater influence than others over affairs of state and the direction of society, and that society's interconnection and interaction with the rest of the world. And in various ways, that greater influence and role will be institutionalized, as indeed it is in every other form of society, but in a different way under socialism. This is a reflection, and in certain ways, a concentration of the underlying social and above all production relations. But here it is important to emphasize two basic points. One, this inequality in influence and decision making is much less in socialist society than it is under capitalism or any other system ruled by exploiting classes. And as experience has highlighted, particularly through the Cultural Revolution in China, one of the main tasks of the socialist revolution and one of the sharpest arenas of class struggle in socialist society takes shape precisely in terms of continuing or whether or not to continue to narrow this difference along with other social inequalities. And two, with the achievement of communism and only in communist society will this discrepancy, this gap, be fully and finally overcome. The superficiality of the analysis of communism as articulated by people like Berman and in turn Isaiah Berlin, and the great distance between this analysis and what communism actually is and aims for, is, to put it bluntly, stunning. And as the foundation for this, so is the total lack of materialism reflected in this whole line of thinking. A lack of understanding that in any situation and any society, wants and needs are in any case socially determined and not some expression of individual will divorced from social and fundamentally production relations. And I've spoken this before, for example, in views on, and I won't repeat it at all here, about how a lot of the youth in the inner cities think they need $1,000 worth of rims for their cars. That is not an idea that's innate to them, that they were born with, or that they developed in the absence of and divorced from the social conditions that surround them and the ideas that go along with those social conditions. For example, people living in the 18th century would not have had the idea of having rims for their wheels on their cars, nor in the future society, when we move beyond this whole crazy car-based economy, will that idea arise either, for many different reasons. So wants and needs are in any case socially determined and are fundamentally shaped by the production and social relations and by the superstructure that basically corresponds to and serves those production and social relations. The mania for shopping in this society among broad strata people, and it's particularly women are targeted in this way, is a socially conditioned and determined thing. There is not a gene for shopping. This is socially and conditioned and determined. So communism is not about telling people what they really want in opposition to what they think they want. It is fundamentally about transforming the production and social relations and along with that the superstructure. It is about achieving the four alls to which I've spoken. The struggle to reach communism and leadership in that struggle is not about a few utopians turning into tyrants, thinking they know better than people what is good for them and making them act accordingly. The struggle to reach communism does involve and does require an advanced force, a vanguard, which if it's going to lead to communism, must and does base itself not on a utopian, but on a scientific understanding of human society and its historical development, and the fact that this has led humanity to the possibility and the historical threshold of the leap to communism, and which on that basis and through applying that outlook and methodology brings this understanding to the masses of people, enables them to take this up and mobilizes them to wage an increasingly conscious struggle in unity with the same fundamental struggle and aims worldwide. To first overthrow the capitalist system and establish the socialist system, and then while defending the socialist state against threats and attacks by remaining reactionary classes and forces and states within the country and internationally, to advance through a whole period of socialist transition to communism on a worldwide basis. Now that, of course, is a very boiled-down statement of the fundamental character and aims of the communist revolution. And as such, it cannot help but include a certain amount of oversimplification. But even with that, it presents the essence of the matter and is a million times closer to the actuality of what communism and communists are all about than the rather silly notions glibly tossed around about utopian totalitarians thinking they know what is good for people and then setting out to force people to act in accordance with this good, whether they like it or not. Such superficiality and distortion, grounded in a lack of materialist dialectics, leads Berman, and in fact far too many like him, to suspend critical thinking and uncritically accept the most grotesque distortions of communism and attacks on communism and the experience of revolutions and socialist societies led by communists, the lurid tales of senseless and bloodthirsty mass murder by totalitarian communist governments in the Soviet Union and China under Mao. And thereby, ironically, it leads these people who take up this viewpoint to end up in a cul-de-sac, a deadening dead end, in what often seems to be a genuinely angst-filled agonizing about the possibility of a better future for humanity. Near the end of Dark Ages America, for example, Berman voices frustrations with the limitations of bourgeois democracy as a model within the U.S. and internationally. And he writes, quote, "If you are really a radical, on the other hand, you are aiming for something else. But what? Time, perhaps, to find out. My own belief is that there is no warding off the dark age." As I've said previously, he's very pessimistic. "My own belief is there is no warding off the dark age. All the evidence points in that direction. But you can certainly do your best to keep it out of your head, which is a contribution of a sort. What is thus called for is long-term study and thought in an effort to come up with a serious alternative to global bourgeois democracy, unquote. And then he expresses agreement with the idea that what is needed now, specifically for radicals, is not action but theory. Now, part of this is very wrong. There is, in fact, a great need now for action, for mass mobilization of resistance, and for very active and bold work aimed at repolarizing things not only for resistance, but more fundamentally for revolution, in order to actually bring about a truly radical alternative to bourgeois democracy and to all the horrors of the capitalist imperialist system of which bourgeois democracy is an outward expression. Yet at the same time, it is very true and very important that in the same context as, and as we would say, in dialectical relation with the need for this kind of political action, there is very definitely and very profoundly a need for theory and for wrangling in the realm of theory and strategic thinking in the broadest and deepest sense. But once again, a great irony here is that so long as Berman and others like him buy into the slanders and distortions of the truly radical and truly emancipating theory and strategic orientation of communism and the communist revolution, they will consign their search for a radical alternative to ultimate and fundamental failure and the further frustration and aimless alienation and cynicism that will inevitably accompany this. Among other things, this illustrates once again and adds further emphasis to the great importance of the whole project of setting the record straight with regard to the historical experience of revolutions and countries led by communists, of socialist society, and the dictatorship of the proletariat. So I want to stop here now, and then we'll have the last section of this talk.